like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animal, talking animal. Talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animals.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest today is Dr. James Keen, a veterinarian and scientist, perhaps one of this era's most significant whistleblowers within the animal welfare realm. Dr. Keen became increasingly troubled by experiments conducted at the U.S. Meat Animal Research Center, where he was employed. These experiments were designed to produce more meat and more profits for farmers, and involved, for example, manipulating cows, who ordinarily have just one calf, to have two or three calves, many of whom were weak and unhealthy, dying shortly after birth. Something similar was done with pigs, who normally give birth to 6 to 8 offspring, but were having, in this case, up to 15 piglets, so many that it was common for the mother to roll over on some and killing some of those babies. Dr. Keen provided information and access to the New York Times, yielding a major front page expose, which led to halting some of the center's research projects, a federal investigation, various reforms and legislation. As often happens with major whistleblowers, Dr. Keen experienced significant repercussions in both his professional and personal life. We'll hear more about this story, the story in the wake of the story, really, when I speak with Dr. James Keen in a moment here on Talking Animals. Later, I'll speak briefly with Linda Barhorst, founder of Sky Harbor Wildlife Rescue and Rehab Center, a Pasco County nonprofit that's been rehabbing and releasing animals for more than 2 decades, but has suffered serious setbacks, including the death of Barhorst's husband, Dave, her partner in operating Sky Harbor, and myriad financial challenges. It's on the verge of shutting down, but there are measures to help rescue Sky Harbor itself, and I'll discuss those with Barhorst later in today's program. Right now, though, let's meet Dr. Keen with a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. Let's welcome Dr. James Keen to Talking Animals. Good morning, Dr. Keen.
Good morning, Donkey, and thank you for inviting me to be on your show.
Thank you so much for joining us today. So to kind of give us some important context as we start to hear your story, I'd like to begin by asking you to describe the U.S. Meat Animal Research Center. I think for many of us it will be rather esoteric operation. So what is it exactly, and when was it launched?
Okay, the Meat Animal Research Center is basically it's in south central Nebraska. It opened up in about 1966 on a former naval base, which actually made ammunition during World War II, and then the U.S. Navy took ownership of it. And it's about 55 square miles in size, which is about twice the size of Manhattan or about the size of Washington, D.C. So it's a big ranch. It has swine, cattle, and sheep. Right now, with the adults and the offspring, there's about 30 to 35,000 animals in the center. And it's the largest meat research center in the world.
So when we say meat research center, maybe can you elaborate on that? What does that really mean? What goes on there?
Well, when I say meat, it means they work with animals whose primary purpose is to produce meat, as opposed to, you know, dairy cattle produce milk, which becomes dairy products. So the focus is on, they use the term conception to consumption. So they have everything from animal breeding all the way through a small slaughter plant. So it's kind of the whole continuum of the life cycle of a meat animal.
But if I follow you based on the name of the facility itself and just what you've said so far, that the objective overall, I guess, is researching ways to produce more and different kinds of meat. I'm sure it oversimplifies it, but is that sort of the fundamental purpose? Or?
Yeah, basically it's primarily a beef or a genetic center. Animal Science Genetics Center. So the idea is use genetics to select animals that produce more. That's basically what the model is.
Right. So more meat means equals more profit than...
Right. The example that you gave, Duncan, of a cow having 3 offspring.
Yeah.
That then, in theory, you get more meat produced by that one cow if they have 3 offspring versus 1. But the problem with that is it's over millions of years, cows were designed to have a single offspring. So when you do that, a lot of bad things tend to happen.
Yeah, what they say about messing with Mother Nature, and I guess this would be a sort of extreme example. Yeah.
I would say there were many examples there, I think, where they messed with Mother Nature.
Yeah.
Generally, Mother Nature doesn't like that.
Right, right. Mother Nature typically rebels. So was this, I know you mentioned this is kind of a big, big operation just in terms of square footage. Was it also pretty singular operation in terms of at least the U.S.? I mean, in other words, were there others that might have been smaller but doing similar kinds of work?
I don't think so, because to do genetics, typically you need large populations.
Okay.
And that, so I think it's very unique in the world. If you're an animal geneticist, it's probably the Mayo Clinic, the NIH, you know, the Cleveland Clinic. It's probably the best place to go if you're an animal geneticist, just because of the size of the population.
Right, and the scope of the work, I guess, that's being done. So when did you start working there, Dr. Keene, and what were you hired to do?
Well, I had several positions over the years there. I was there for many, I can't even remember, 24 years. Or something. It was my first job out of veterinary school, was a clinical veterinarian taking care of the animals there. Ended up becoming and getting my PhD. They funded my PhD, did my research there, and then I was with a veterinary researcher there from, let me see, 91 until 2007. So quite a long career there. And then I joined the University of Nebraska, has a small veterinary clinic based on the center, and I joined that clinic in 2007. Which was a teaching research position. So I've had various roles on the center over those years that I was there.
When you joined the University of Nebraska's veterinary clinic in 2007, was that still considered under the overall purview of the U.S. Meat Animal Research Center, or was that sort of a separate?
Yeah, it was separate. It wasn't regulated by the. It wasn't regulated by MARC. It was sort of co-located there, but it wasn't regulated by the U.S. MARC.
I see. Was there a notable change in the sort of research being conducted at the center? I mean, again, as you pointed out, you were there a number of years. What sorts of changes did you see at the center, maybe in the more recent years, even though you were, I guess, as of 2007, spending more of your time on the veterinary clinic university side?
Well, I don't. Most of the research projects there are long-term. By long-term, I mean 30 years. And so the research didn't change, but I would say that I changed.
Okay. So a lot of things, for example, since I mentioned it and then you mentioned it again, the thing with the manipulating the cows to instead of having one calf, having two or three, that represents a long-term project that was underway at MARC, as you call it, acronym.
Yeah, that project went for 30 years, and then it was terminated mostly because the cow producer said, we don't want it.
Because of the frail health of the calves that were produced?
Well, yeah, because when you have calves, you know, again, a cow is designed to have a single offspring.
Yeah.
So what happens is, there's a lot of bad things that happen. You have dystocias, which is a difficult birth. You know, the parts get caught together. The cows are more likely to get mastitis, inflammation of the mammary glands. If you happen to have twins where one is a male and one is a female, the female will be sterile, has an abnormal reproductive tract. So there's just a lot of things that happen that are not good. So then that's why a lot of times most farmers, if the animal has twins, they get rid of that cow. They don't want twins. So they were not only going against nature, they were also going against the industry.
Right. It sounds like not only against nature, but against the anomalies of nature. If you're saying that, like, when just in regular settings, when a cow has twins, it's like, hey, that's trouble. That's a red flag just naturally.
Right.
Yeah.
As I said, typically a farmer would get rid of that animal, doesn't want that genetics in his herd.
Now, again, maybe part of the work that, again, on the scale that you're talking about that takes place at the center, maybe this partly answers this question, but why, given all those things and given that people were not responding favorably to the calves that were produced in this way, why would a study like this span 30 years? Why would it not be cut much shorter than that and just say, okay, well, I don't know what we were thinking here, but it's just not going to work out and let's not keep going.
I think the biggest reason, Duncan, is the funding is automatic. You know, for example, I'm in a university setting right now, and if you want to get funding, you have to write a proposal, and it goes against anybody else submitting in that process. Maybe 20% get funded. But at U.S. MARC, the money comes every year no matter what. So you don't have the freedom. I mean, there's some advantage of that, and that's long term. But the downside of that is that there's no impetus to do work that is, let's say, it's not competitive, so you can basically do whatever you want without consequence. Does that sort of make sense?
Well, I understand what you're saying. Whether it makes sense is probably a separate issue. But I guess then the key obvious question there is, well, why does that funding just roll over automatically? How is that designed, or what's going on? Because these are government monies, right?
Right. These are tax. How it basically works is there's roughly $2 billion a year that the USD allocates for research. And of that $2 billion goes to the USDA Ag Research Service, which is what the U.S. Mark is part of. There's about 100 USDA Ag Research Service centers across the country. Mark is probably the biggest one. Mark has a budget of $22 to $23 million, but they also make an additional $5 million from the sale of excess livestock. So they have about $28 billion per year. Over about the 50 years of existence on the center, they've had probably $1.2 to $1.5 billion in public funding.
Wow.
So it's a lot of money. They just celebrated their 50th anniversary about 2 years ago, I believe.
The center did, the U.S. Meat Animal Research.
That's correct.
Center. Well, again, you call it MARC as an acronym for short.
Yeah, I'm sorry for some of the acronyms.
No. I think as long as the listeners know, then that's fine. And one thing, too, since I know a lot of listeners probably that are pretty familiar with a lot of legislation and animal welfare-related things might be thinking, well, these actions sound like pretty clear and in some cases extreme violations of the Animal Welfare Act. Unfortunately, as it turns out, that farm animals are excluded from the protections afforded by that act. Is that not right, Dr. King?
Actually, it's not farm animals.
Oh.
It's federally owned.
Federally, okay.
That's the difference.
Okay. So the ones, for our purpose of our discussion, it's the same because the animals that are present, and you said there's 30, 35,000 animals present at MARC, they are then exempt from
That's
the protections
correct.
Of Animal Welfare Act. Okay.
That's correct.
Yikes. This is Talking Animals, by the way. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just tuned in, my guest is Dr. James Keene, a veterinarian and scientist who served as a whistleblower about the U.S. Meat Animal Research Center, or MARC, approaching the New York Times, yielding a major front page expose, which in turn led to federal investigation, various reforms, legislation, and more. There are also, of course, repercussions for Dr. Keene, as there often are for whistleblowers. If you'd like to ask Dr. Keene a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663, email dj@wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. In asking you about what sort of experiments or research changed at the center, you noted that not really much of anything, but that you changed. Describe that change. What really started to trouble you about what was going on there, since you obviously had a long tenure at the center?
Well, I guess I can say when I went through veterinary school, what I was taught, and it may still be taught, it was that if an animal is producing and reproducing, its welfare is fine. So that's kind of the background that is operating from. And then when I joined the University of Nebraska, this veterinary clinic, in 2007, I had very small clinical duties, but I had lots of colleagues who were three or four colleagues who were full-time clinicians, and they would tell me stories. I also saw things, and so I started keeping a log of the things that I saw that started bothering me. So I'd say basically I went from a atheist in terms of animal welfare, that it's not real, to an agnostic, thinking, you know, maybe there's, well, I knew there was something wrong with that. And then I became a whistleblower when I crossed a threshold, and now I would call myself an activist. So I think I just had blinders on.
And it sounds like part of that, those were cultural blinders.
Absolutely. Part of it is when you're in the environment that I was in, it was a silo. Everybody kind of thought the same way. And even right now, I'm positive that the scientists and the staff at U.S. MARC believe they did absolutely nothing wrong. Most of the producers in Nebraska probably think whatever private producers, probably they did nothing wrong, because a lot of it is the experiments are not, I'd say they're abnormal, but a lot of the producers in Nebraska might defend them as necessary. Not all of them, but some of them they might. So it was definitely going countercultural how I was thinking it, certainly.
So you're saying your colleagues there in the silo even now would say, hey, we weren't doing anything wrong, and so it sounds like therefore the next step in that thinking would be, hey, just Dr. Keene, I mean, he's gone rogue. He's gone a bit nuts on us.
I think that would be true, yeah.
That speaks so many volumes.
I should tell you this the story, for example.
Sure.
I mean, I was, after this happened, I had lots of visits by the police, you know, the local police, the state troopers, the University of Nebraska police, and even the FBI. And when the FBI officer interviewed me, he had previously visited the MARC director, and he said the MARC director referred to me as the evilest person on the planet.
Oh, my goodness.
Which I thought was interesting. interesting. I should have a shirt made up on that or something.
Yeah, that's quite a sweeping award of sorts,
yeah,
I guess.
You can imagine what they think of me.
They just kept doing what they're doing, but you kind of traveled this path that you described from atheist to agnostic to whistleblower to activist. So when you were in the first part of that transformation, just seeing kind of what was going on, which had gone on the previous week and the previous month and probably the previous year, it did what to you? As you were changing, how did it hit you differently?
Well, I think it was just a recognized, again, at least in the transformation from atheist, nothing is wrong, you know, not a real problem, to being agnostic. I just started, you know, seeing things and hear about things myself, and I had to question, you know, I had to question in my own mind what was going on. It just wasn't right. Now, this transformation, I have to say, it wasn't immediate. This occurred over several years, you know, because, again, it was countercultural, and especially when you get to the whistleblower stage. I don't talk about that later, but, and I knew there would be severe, knowing the culture, I knew there would be severe repercussions if I did that, which, frankly, is one reason why I delayed it.
Right. Well, no, I was just going to say that there probably were times as you traveled that continuum where you may have found a sort of two-step forward, one-step back, or maybe vice versa thing where you thought, yeah, this is bugging me, but I just don't know how far I'm willing to go with this. And probably, again, when you were first making that transformation, you probably thought, well, what is wrong with me?
Yeah. Well, one thing I did do for many years, probably 6 or 7 years before I blew the whistle, was I reported this to my immediate supervisors, you know, during my annual review or when I saw them, and it just got nowhere, which is the channel you're supposed to take.
Right. Well, that was certainly a question I had intended to ask. So we're there now. When these things were bothering you, did you go through proper channels? And it sounds like you just said that you did. And did they just stare blankly at you or make a little note in your record? Or, I mean, what happened?
Well, I think philosophically, I don't think in the culture that I'm in, even with the University of Nebraska, we're a big ag factory farming state. And that's the belief, whether it's the USDA or the University of Nebraska. But in fairness to the University of Nebraska, you know, I told you this, the veterinary center that I worked at is not part of MARC. So they really had no way to directly influence U.S. MARC. But my channel was, I mean, not directly. They could have said something to a director, but they had no direct influence on MARC. So that's all I could do was report up my own food chain, so to speak. And I did that, but it just didn't get anywhere, and that's one reason I also realized that wasn't going to work. The approach that was in place to deal with that was not going to work.
Right. The proper channels were just going nowhere fast, and
right.
So that's, I guess, as you continue to travel that continuum from atheist to agnostic to now you're sort of brushing up against whistleblower territory, I guess the thought was, if I'm going to do anything or if I'm going to affect any change, this is what's going to be required.
Right. That's what I realized.
Well, that's really interesting because the world of whistleblowers is, I think, just inherently fascinating, in part because it's rife with dilemmas, some of which you've already addressed, and more than occasionally sort of crisis of conscience and confidence both. I mean, especially when it comes to how to act and when to act when you finally are on that point where you think, okay, nothing's going to happen unless I go all the way in. Can you describe a little bit more about the pivotal component, obviously, of this saga is you're deciding to contact the New York Times, and that was the means really through which the whistle was blown effectively. How did you figure out, okay, that's the official channel's no good, I got to become a whistleblower, and this is the form my whistleblowing would take? Were there other things you considered first, or was it like, the only way to really shake things up on a significant level is going to somewhere like the New York Times?
Well, first of all, I should say I was, I did try another route with suggesting to an animal protection group to go undercover at a certain time, which is sort of being chicken on my part, somebody else to do the dirty work.
Sure.
And that didn't work out. They tried, but that didn't work. I don't want to name the organization.
Out of curiosity, Dr. King, it sounds like you're protecting them, but is there a reason in particular? I'm not going to press you on who it is if you're not going to say it, but I'm just curious why you prefer not to say.
It's just better for that organization.
I see.
I just don't say anything.
Okay.
Yeah, and anyway, that didn't work out. But again, that was partly my fault. I didn't want to take, you know, trying to transfer the risk in a way, right?
Right.
Because it's actually, if there are certain times of year, it wouldn't take long. I mean, I know how the place works. I would know where to go, and it wouldn't take long to do it.
Yeah.
Get the film. But so then after that, again, I'm trying to pass the buck, basically. then I decided to, I found, by doing a Google search, I found Michael Moss, the reporter. He'd won a Pulitzer Prize. He'd worked in an area, his Pulitzer Prize was an area that I worked in for many years, which is E. coli 157, which is a bacterial contaminant of beef that kills and sickens a lot of people, including my my niece, almost died from it.
Oh, wow.
Ago. So there was sort of a connection there, and I did a little kind of a cryptic email to him, and then he got back to me, and we sort of went back and forth and developed some trust. And basically, in the end, I knew where all the dead bodies were buried in a way.
Right.
So I knew what he needed to FOIA because I knew what existed, and I think he FOIA'd about 10,000 pages of documents.
And we should point out again for listeners that acronym is the Freedom of Information Act, which in this case was critical to get a lot of documents that would underscore the story that you were telling to. Michael Moss, but so that he could actually tell the story on a broader scale at the New York Times. But also for the reporting of the piece beyond the FOIA request, I mean, he wanted and I think needed to get access to the center itself, and I guess you sort of provided him that access.
Yeah, I did. That turned out to be a case where there's a project there called the Easy Care Sheep, and it's a group. It's basically the project is you put the sheep industry, commercial sheep industry, is on a death spiral. It's almost dead. There were about 50 million sheep 50 years ago, and now there's about 3 million. So this was sort of a last gasp attempt by U.S. Mark to save the sheep industry, and the method they used was just basically put sheep on pasture by themselves without shelter and just let them on their own. Don't provide any assistance for lambing, don't provide any assistance for the newborn lambs, don't try to protect from the weather. They had some protection from predators in the sense that they had some guard dogs, not very effective. So basically try to convert, in my opinion, it's basically trying to convert domestic sheep into a wild sheep, which they're not very adapted to. Sheep have been domesticated for about 10,000 years. So you can imagine there were lots of bad things happened, especially to the lambs. They would die from hypothermia, got too cold, they would die from dystocia, difficult birth, they would die from starvation because they wouldn't bond to the mother. So there are a whole bunch of things that happened there. And Michael Moss wanted to see that. And to credit of the New York Times, you know, he would not take any hearsay. He had to see things directly. So he came, it was Mother's Day actually in 2014, because I knew that was the time when it was peak lambing time, when there'd be lots of events. It was on a Sunday, and I'd arranged to meet him the day before, I think. We went out to the center, and there was another veterinarian I was going to do some work with that day later in the day, but she happened to show up early in the day, a couple hours earlier, so she saw Michael Moss and myself there, and that's how I got outed.
How did she know? Oh, she just knew that it wasn't an employee, or did she also somehow know or figure out that it was a New York Times reporter?
I think that Michael Moss had been out a couple of times before.
Oh, in a different capacity, you mean? Or?
Just to visit, and I think I probably introduced her to him as a friend, you know, New York Times person. I believe that was the case. I'm not actually sure. But anyway, U.S. Mark just would not allow a visitor on the center, you know, like that.
That'd be so unusual.
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
So then, you know, it was a myth. It was failed thinking on my part that I could sort of keep secret.
And right.
So that's when my bubble got popped.
So once you're down that path and you're kind of busted, but this is still while he's reporting the story and collecting research and doing other elements, so you're in trouble as a whistleblower even before the fruits of the whistleblowing have had a chance to materialize.
Yeah, this was in May of 2014, and the New York Times piece didn't come out till January of
2015. Yeah.
But one thing the timing actually was perfect because, I mean, during the time that Michael Moss was there, we had a huge hailstorm, and that hailstorm killed like 120 lambs.
Ugh.
So just to give an example, the timing was really good. And I knew, I mean, again, I know the center, I knew when to be there, but it was just, not that it was good for the lambs, but it was good for the story. Kind of showing that this is what's happening when you leave lambs in an unprotected environment that they're not adapted to.
Right. And well, just especially that it's just a random day that Michael happened to be there.
Right. Well, it wasn't random. It was I knew that this was the time to be there. The storm was random, let's say.
Right. That's what I mean. Like the fact that you went there on Mother's Day and all these things were going to be more for him to see, but I guess the adverse side of it was probably more extreme than you would have anticipated based on the storm.
Right.
Yeah. Let's get into then when the New York Times piece did run. By the way, if you just joined us, my guest is Dr. James Keene, a veterinarian and scientist who became a major whistleblower through a major New York Times piece, the results of which involved major reforms. The center he'd been working brought significant changes to his professional and personal life, and there was other effects as well. We invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj at wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. Okay, it's January 15th. The story runs front page, big expose in the New York Times. What happened then, generally and separately? We'll get into what happened for you.
Well, I probably just step back because after I was outed back in May, after that I was banned from the center and put on administrative leave. So that happened 6 months before. And as it turned out, I didn't actually go back to work from that point until 17 months later because of all the let's say they didn't like me.
So you were in trouble, but you weren't fired.
I wasn't fired.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wasn't, because as it turned out, part of the reason was, again, I worked for University of Nebraska, and what the things that I did were against USDA policy, but they were not against UNL policy, University of Nebraska policy.
Oh, wow. Interesting. And so,
I was fortunate in a sense that that I worked for the University of Nebraska, and I worked for an institution that was independent of Mark. So that sort of...
Right. So if this had happened, not that it would have because of your journey, as it were, but if this had happened before you went to work for the veterinary clinic in 2007, for example, then the impact might have been very different because you'd be a more direct employee still, if I follow you, of Mark.
Terminated.
Yeah.
Almost certainly.
I got you. Wow. Interesting. Okay.
And, I didn't know this, of course, at that time, you know.
Yeah. So you're suspended, and this is May, and the piece isn't going to come out for another 7-8 months. So then
so I can say what happened then. After that, was my first round of dealing with most of the University of Nebraska police. You know, they were calling me and trying to interview me and et cetera after this first came, after in May. And the second round of that was after the New York Times piece came out. That's when another whole round of state troopers and the FBI and University of Nebraska police, you know.
And what were they doing, or what were they asking, or what were they hoping to find?
Well, again, it was sort of cryptic, but basically the FBI agent who visited me, was his expertise was eco-terrorism. So I think the belief was that I was, I can basically say the belief was that I was an eco-terrorist, or that I was collaborating with eco-terrorists.
Wow.
Even though I wasn't.
Right. I mean, you knew what had happened. And again, the journey that we've talked about from atheist, et cetera, to whistleblower, and then we'll get into, I guess, activists after that. But for them, they thought, well, yeah, I don't know what this guy's doing, but it's nefarious. It's not just whistleblowing.
Right. But I think it was also harassment.
Okay.
Opinion.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
there may have been some belief on that part, but there was no data to support that.
Yeah.
If you want to call whistleblowing a form of eco-terrorism, which I don't think it is.
Well, obviously, they couldn't find anything ultimately to support that premise because there wasn't anything.
That's right.
Yeah. What started to happen in the wake of the New York Times piece? Obviously, you got harassed more. You got more visits from the campus and other police, and I guess what the FBI must have been involved at some point if there's a terrorism element, right?
Yeah, one interesting anecdote, when the FBI, of course it's unannounced, he came with UNL police officer, he knocked on the door, and he said, "I'm so-and-so with the FBI, don't worry, you're not in trouble." And I said,
BS,
I said,
yeah.
The FBI doesn't show up your door.
Yeah.
If you're not in trouble. And he said, "Okay, yeah, you're right." You know, it irritated me, though.
Yeah.
Just tell me the truth, you know?
Right. Well, yeah, I don't know who he thought he was going to be fooling with that, but so let's talk then a little bit about in the wake of the New York Times piece, there was obviously kind of seismic reaction. So what sort of changes did that yield? What sort of impact did that yield, both at the center and on a broader level?
Changes on the center?
Yeah, but didn't they have to alter at least some of the projects, research, and other stuff that they were doing?
Yeah, that actually, I'm kind of been shunned by that community, so I'm not actually sure what has happened. But
okay.
I am aware, because it was a former graduate student of mine, was recently hired on, and his whole purpose is to do something called IACUC, which means Institutional Animal Care and Use Protocol. And what that means is every other institution, and Mark was supposed to do this, it's basically a process when an experiment is designed that it's concerned with the pain and welfare of the animals. And that had been completely ignored, even though it had been mandated by USDARS. Secondly, the animals at US Mark were until very recently owned by the University of Nebraska, and University of Nebraska has a very good Institutional Animal Care and Use Committee protocol, but they exempted the animals at US Mark from that protocol, sort of like federal animals are exempted from the Animal Welfare Act.
Right, right.
So it was the same type of a thing. Again, that just gave Mark, U.S. Mark, freedom to do whatever they want without considering the animal welfare or animal pain consequences. The whole reason that protocol was put in place.
Right.
And if it would have been in place, many of these experiments either would never have been approved or they would have been terminated early.
Sure. Boy, they had outs every which way, it sounds like.
They did.
And then I think there were sort of broader reforms and even legislation of one kind or another, or at least some kind of bill that
There were some. There was one bill called the AWARE Act. It's an acronym which I can't remember, and it was sponsored, I know, by Cory Booker, who's a senator from New Jersey,
sure,
and some others. And it was basically to remove the exemption of federal research livestock from the Animal Welfare Act. And I don't think that's going to go anywhere. It's on life support right now.
Yeah.
One thing that did happen is that the agency that administers the Animal Welfare Act is a federal agency called the USDA Animal Plant, it's APHIS. I can't remember what APHIS stands for.
Okay.
But they have an animal welfare, they're the ones who enforce the Animal Welfare Act. And so what they did is they basically, the federal government said, or the Congress and Senate said, that Mark is subject to the Animal Welfare Act. Even though they're not, by law, functionally, they have to have inspections by APHIS for animal welfare. And I just heard that they had an inspection by USDA APHIS, I believe, in January of this year, and they had lots and lots of violations.
So if I follow you, this was almost an exemption in the opposite direction.
It is.
Yeah, interesting.
The other thing that's happened is they've had 5% of the budget of the USDA Ag Research Service held back. So 5% of $1.2 billion they've had held back.
Wow, that'll get people's attention.
Yeah, for the past, well, you know, the only thing that's really going to work is money. So I don't know what 5% of $1.2 billion, but it's a good chunk of change.
Well, as we often find in these kinds of stories, it all seems to come right down to the dollar. So,
you know, when Michael Moss, one of the first, maybe the very first question Michael Moss asked him when I contacted him, which would have been, let me see, I mean, it was at least a year before the story came out, so early in January 2014, he said, what do you want to happen? And I said, I just want the conditions for animals at U.S. Mark to change. And it turns out, I mean, that is happening, pulling teeth. Mark is resisting completely, but they have no choice. But it's also had a much broader effect. I mean, all of the USDA, ARS, Ag Research Service facilities that have animals, and it's about 40 of the 100, they're all subjected to the animal welfare inspections by the USDA APHIS. So it's had a much broader impact than what I initially said I wanted.
That's great and something like this where it can actually exceed expectations. That's not a minute too soon, probably. So, and how about for you? What sort of impact, you noted you were out of work for that 17 months as a suspension, and presumably you've been reinstated, I guess? Or
yeah, it was after a long negotiations that I was reinstated, but I was transferred from where I worked before. Of course, I was banned from the U.S. Mark, surprising.
Sure.
And so the choice was either relocate to Lincoln, Nebraska, which is about 105 miles away, or not have a job. That sort of thing.
Ah, okay.
So, and that took a lot of negotiating. So I had to hire an attorney, and I spent a lot of money on the attorney. But it worked. I mean, I'm glad I spent the money because it kept my job. Otherwise, if I didn't hire that attorney, I would have been fired. And I'm tenured faculty, but he had defended previous faculty who were tenured and kept their jobs.
Wow.
I also got sick, probably from the stress. I had two gigantic, you know, USDA and U.S. Nebraska coming down on me. So that was those are both heavy financial burdens I had.
Right. So it sounds like when you say sick, we're talking about some significant illness.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That it required hospitalization for quite some time.
And how's your health now, Dr. King?
It's much better than it was.
Okay.
It was.
But it sounds like you're not all the way back.
Not all the way, but
yeah.
On the way.
Yeah.
And then on the personal side, again, the town I lived in was very, most everybody's related to agriculture in some way, and I lost a lot of friends. I think I was considered a traitor.
Yeah, pariah.
My wife divorced me because she thought I just was stupid and was too risky.
Afraid
someone would burn the house down. Again, you have to think about the community you're in. So she had some. There were some valid points, you know, that she made. I can't disagree with some of the. She didn't disagree with me whistleblowing, but she disagreed maybe with how I did it, that it was just too risky of a way.
I see. Wow.
As I said, I was away from work. I had job termination threats. I had, because of all the police visits, I had fear of arrest or criminal prosecution. But I was kind of a typical whistleblower case. There's a great book. If anybody's thinking about being a whistleblower, it's called The Whistleblower's Handbook. I don't know who wrote it, but I'd recommend if you're thinking about that. I wish I would have read that book beforehand. I could have saved myself some trouble.
Oh, yeah. Interesting. Yeah. It's a pretty select audience, I would think. But for those who find themselves in that situation, yeah. Because, in fact, I was going to ask you at one point towards the end here, what sort of guidance you might offer to a whistleblower, or especially someone contemplating becoming a whistleblower.
Yeah. I mean, about 80% of the time, if you're a whistleblower, it's going to turn out badly for you. And in that sense, I was very typical. So what happened to me is kind of casebook. I mean, not casebook. It's very typical what happens. I mean, the divorce, the not working, or losing your job.
Sure, shunned by...
So that's... I'm not unusual at all in that case. Spending a lot of legal expenses, medical expenses, that pretty much happens in most cases. Yeah.
Well, we're sort of nearing the end of our time, Dr. Keene, but there's been a few callers. One's been holding for quite some time, so I feel like at least I should try to get them involved in the conversation before we say goodbye to you. So, hi, you're on Talking Animals with Dr. Keene.
Yes, I first have to say thanks for having Talking Animals, which is, you know, the most compelling program on this station. Second, Dr. Keene, you're a freedom fighter. You're a hero. And unfortunately, as you see throughout human history with Jesus, Gandhi, Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy, the environmental activists, especially in South America, when you stand up against the human tendency to imprison, torture, exploit, and abuse innocent, sweet animals, you get persecuted by the human machine. My question for you is this, is what disconnect in people's hearts, souls, and consciences allows them to work in these experimental places, in these slaughterhouses, and not feel the obvious suffering that they're causing to other sentient beings?
Thanks for your question, and we have just about a minute left, Dr. Keene, if you want to. I'm sure that, I mean, that's the question that requires much more than a minute, but I know we've sort of touched on just the cultural nature of that, but if there's something else you would like to respond to our caller with, feel free, please.
You know, that's a very good question, and you have to remember, too, that I was an enabler of that system for a long time. So I think primarily it's being within a given culture, and what you see is what is normal. But I think also that if people were, I'll use the word educated, they might look at things differently. But I think the primary issue is cultural. You know, if you look at history, a lot of people have done some bad things to humans or to animals, and they don't see it a problem at the time. That's probably not a very good answer to your question.
But I think, again, I mean, because you really sort of get a picture from the way you describe things early on and a few other points in our conversation here about stepping into this world where what to many of us sounds pretty horrific was the quote-unquote norm. And so it's only someone that was a real guy undergoing a transformation, as you did and as you explained, that would ever have occasion to say, hey, this is wrong here, or this bothers me, or I've got to do something.
Yeah.
But that's exactly what a whistleblower is, and whistleblowers are rare, at least this kind of, this level of whistleblowing.
Also, I think in some cases, I've heard of cases of people who just left, you know, if they'd not because your choice is either adapt or leave.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's the thing. We don't know how many of those there were, but...
I know there were some.
I'm sure. But it's one thing to say, okay, this is wrong and I'm leaving. It's another thing to say, this is wrong and I'm going to do something about it. So Dr. Keene, we've been speaking with Dr. James Keene. And Dr. Keene, thank you so much for making the time, and mainly, of course, for taking these steps and undergoing this transformation and talking about it, because I think it does inspire other people who might be considering their own sort of acts of whistleblowing to say, okay, yeah, it's never great for the whistleblower, but it's sometimes, in this case included, very much worth it.
Well, if I could say one thing.
Please.
I was on another radio interview show just a couple of months ago, and the last question the interviewer asked me was, given what happened to you, would you do it again? And I thought for about 5 or 6 seconds. Nobody asked that before, and I said, I'd do it again, yes.
I heard you explain that, and so I guess I'm also interested, although we're going a little bit over time, but just quickly to follow up on that, I'm also interested to know, in retrospect, what you might do differently. Would you act sooner? Would you take a different approach? Or would you largely do, in retrospect, what you ended up doing?
I would probably do something very similar to what I did, because I really didn't have any choice under the circumstances.
Well, that's good to know. And that's probably good for your own peace of mind as you sort of deal with various consequences of the whistleblowing itself. But Dr. Keene, well, thank you for your work. Thank you for your whistleblowing. And thanks for joining us today on Talk Animals. I really appreciate it.
It's been my pleasure.
Thank you. In a moment, I'll have a brief conversation with Linda Barhorst, who for more than 20 years has rescued and rehabbed animals at her Pasco County Wildlife Rescue. Sky Harbor, things have reached something of a crisis point at Sky Harbor, and we'll hear about that and ways to help when I speak with her in just a moment. Right now, it's time to step into the comedy corner with the Dr. Keene conversation in mind. I thought we'd hear part of this piece from Mike Kaplan called Meats and Robots in today's comedy corner on Talking Animals.
I ate a lot of fake meat, like your tofurkies, your phony bolognese, your not dogs. Those are real names of fake meats. Inspire me to come up with some fake names for fake meats that aren't real yet. Like a fake chicken called Fiction, how about that one? Or chicken pretenders, that's nice. Or baby back fibs, or a fake deer called Venisant. I don't know, you know? Work with me. Some people wonder, why do you want to eat fake meat when you don't like meat? You don't eat meat. Why do you want something that pretends to be the thing that you don't like? Well, I answer that. Because I don't like the suffering involved in the creation of meat, but I'm fine to have it look like it or smell or taste like it if you can do it without the suffering. Like the same way I don't like slavery, but I'd be fine to have robots that look like black people. Obviously, there may be something wrong with that. Okay, hold on. Let me back up for a second and try to figure that out. Something is amiss. Wait, I have it. It is that if you eat fake chicken in front of a real chicken, it doesn't give a shit. But if you have a black robot in front of a black human, it's like, what the f***? And as for a black robot eating fake chicken, haven't figured that one out yet. So... something about the singularity, I think. Not everything that's fake is good. I got a fake number from a girl once, and it was the square root of -1. I was like, lady, that's so irrational. Boom, I got her, and...
That was Mike Kaplan with a portion of a piece called Meats and Robots, taken from his album, not coincidentally called Meats Robots. Now, to hear a bit about the challenges currently faced by Sky Harbor Wildlife Rehabilitation, let's welcome its founder, Linda Barhorst, to Talking Animals. Good morning, Linda.
Good morning, Duncan.
Thanks for joining us in Talking Animals. First, for our listeners who may not be as familiar with Sky Harbor Wildlife Rehabilitation, then maybe you could give us a quick overview of what it is and what it's done over these 20-plus years.
Okay, Sky Harbor is a nonprofit 501c3 organization. What we do is we rescue and rehabilitate injured and orphaned wildlife. We are permitted through Fish and Game, and I hold a state permit to do so. It is illegal to possess wildlife without those permits. We started rescuing, actually I've rescued all my life, but we actually started Sky Harbor in the mid-90s and developed it into a nonprofit organization. So over these years, we have rescued and repaired and released and raised many, many orphan wildlife and got them back into the wild where they belong.
And give us an example of, say, 4 or 5 different kind of animals that have passed through your doors over those years.
Okay, we do raccoons, possums, squirrels, many songbirds, hawks, owls. We've done some of the sandhill cranes, fawns, small deer. Just about anything that comes through, we'll take it, or we're able to refer it to other people and rescues who do them.
So you're 20-plus years into that now. I know that you've experienced some setbacks in the last year and a half or so. Can you talk a little bit about those and what impact they've had?
We bought the property here in Hudson in 2005 and expanded and built it up with the help of everyone who was generous enough to donate to us and to come out and give us physical labor. And in January of 2015, my husband passed away unexpectedly. And that kind of threw everything into a turmoil here. Now I'm responsible for all the bills, and it's gotten a little tough. Yeah. Donations have really fallen off, so it's made it really hard. I've struggled along and maybe did a little bit less on the wildlife and took in a few less. And we started a GoFundMe account, which has raised the money, but now we also have fences coming down. We have new roofs needed on enclosures and a lot of repair and cleanup that at my age I can't do by myself anymore. So we've raised some money to get that repaired, and we've got some people who've come forward to do physical labor for us, but we still need more and we still need the help, just basic cleanup and repairs and stuff like that.
So it sounds like, if I follow you, there's at least two main ways people could help. They hear your story and say, oh geez, I'd like to step up in some way. So obviously donating through the GoFundMe, and if you can just search GoFundMe and just put in Sky Harbor, it comes right up. I did it just before I came on the air just to make sure.
Right.
So that's that's a very simple way to, if you want to throw a few bucks in the kitty for that. But it also sounds like just volunteering your time and efforts to help restore the fences or other tasks that need to be done there to kind of get things back up to ship shape.
Yes, if anybody is interested, probably next weekend or the week after, they can contact me, and we're going to have like probably a Saturday where we get a group of people come out and do a lot of different projects. And if anyone would like to donate like stockade fencing or items like that, you know, that they are not using anymore, we do that too. Most of the places built with items that were donated or thrown away. And they can just give me a call and see what we need, or if they have something, call us and say, you know, is this something you could use? And we'll go from there.
So, Linda, what are a couple different means to contact you? If you want to give your phone number, you're welcome to do that. If there's either a website or an email that where people could contact you either about donating materials or just donating their time on some of those projects, what's the best way to reach you?
Either one. We have a website, which is skyharborwildlife.org.
Okay.
And all of our information is on that site, along with my email, so they can contact me that way, or they can just stop by, you know, but let me know what you've got to donate first to make sure that we can use it.
Sure. I got you. Well, we wish you good luck, because you've obviously done a lot of great work for a lot of animals over a lot of years, and it just sounds like Sky Harbor itself could use a little rescuing itself right now. So
exactly. Yeah. This time it's our turn, I guess.
Right. Well, let's hope that people step up in one way or another, and good luck to you, and thanks again for all your great work.
Great. Thank you for having us, Duncan.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Coming up at 11 on WMNF, it's Rob Lori and Radioactivity, rolling into the noon hour. Concerts, a full 2 hours of interviews, phone calls, news, and more, with contributions from members of the stellar WMNF staff, including, of course, Everyday Ethics with Craig Kopp. Meanwhile, the prize for Name That Animal Tune, I'll be offering a Talking Animals t-shirt. In fact, we're going to get into that presently. Name That Animal Tune is a giveaway. Please only participate if you haven't won something from WNF in the last 90 days. And there'll be a prize, a Talking Animals t-shirt. The first person who calls 813-239-9663 and identifies this animal tune. It's Name That Animal Tune on Talking Animals. Can you name that animal tune? If so, we'll take your guess off the air, because we have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. Rob Lori is up next with Radioactivity. I'll be back next Wednesday, July 6th, when my guest will be Jamie Katz, who runs the only licensed private investigation agency in Florida that specializes in locating pets. So yes, she is a pet detective. Hope you'll join me for that conversation next Wednesday on Talking Animals. Also visit talkinganimals.net, where there's audio archives of every show we ever broadcast, iTunes podcast as well, links to the Talking Animals Facebook page or Twitter feed and more. Please like us on Facebook. Actually, this is good to friend me personally, as well as liking the Facebook page for Talking Animals Radio Show. You can also find out other information by subscribing to our newsletter. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. This is Talking Animals on WMNF, Tampa, Clearwater, Largo, Weekiwachee, and beyond. Let's catch up with you next Wednesday.